The following program is pre-recorded. Welcome to a very unusual show. I say unusual simply because we have some living witnesses to what our guest is going to testify to. I don't know if it's really a testifying or just an interview as such, but we've done many of these shows in which researchers come on and they talk about certain incidents in the past, but all of the witnesses are either dead or missing or something. This is not the case this time around. Our subject is President Eisenhower, meeting with ETs. Now, most of us have heard about the Edwards Air Force Base affair in 1954, but our guest, Art Campbell, a UFO researcher, has found some evidence that holds up, in my opinion, about a possible Eisenhower ET meeting at the end of a runway, not at Edwards, but at Holloman Air Force Base, right outside Albuquerque in New Mexico, in February of 1955. Stay tuned, we're going to present some of the living witnesses and their testimony. But before we do that, let's talk to Art Campbell. Welcome to the show, Art, and I think it's best probably to maybe explain to the audience a little bit about your backgrounds.
Well, I've been a UFO researcher actively since 1989. All before that, I was very active with NICAP and 30 years of teaching involved. So I was
teaching a
high school teacher. A high school teacher.
High school, okay.
High school. I taught high school. I was a school administrator. I was an art teacher.
Was up in Oregon where you live now?
No, actually, I was teaching in started teaching in Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay.
I graduated from the Art Institute there in Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. Started teaching Kansas City, Kansas, and then we moved west to Colorado in the 60s, and I pretty well hung up the UFO stuff for about 25 or 30 years because there's very little interest in UFOs in small towns, and we moved back to southern Oregon in the town of Medford, where I got reinterested in UFOs.
I'm quite familiar with
that. The background of Eisenhower going on his vacation trip to
Now, this is not the first time Eisenhower has told the press he's going to do something. He did something differently. Remember the dental story in Edwards Air Force Base?
Well, this was a year afterwards.
I know.
Apparently, he learned from that experience and decided when he went down and went to visit the aliens again, if that's what was his agenda, that he was not going to have the press hanging all over his neck. And so he slipped them this time on totally. Now, they didn't know he was coming to Holloman, but people back there thought he was laid up with a cold in at a plantation house owned by Secretary of the Treasury Humphrey.
And that was in Georgia.
That was in Thomasville, Georgia. Yes.
So the press was far, far away.
They were far, far away, 5 hours and 1,300 miles, we figure.
Have you been able to figure out what was going on, who he was meeting with exactly? I mean, is this the same group probably that he met at Edwards, or do you have any idea?
I don't know about – I don't have information about Edwards. But
yeah.
I can talk to the fact that it was said he went there. I don't doubt that there was alien material there. I don't know whether he would talk to them or not, or if things have been set up. You know, it takes a while to get interpreters and things like that ready to go to do any real business. I'm sure that there were some alien bodies there. We know that there was lots of UFOs seen at Edwards, and it's quite possible that he did see and talk to someone there.
But you have the evidence on Holloman here firsthand.
Right.
And Holloman seems to have been, in fact, New Mexico really seems to be the center of a lot of UFO activity and ET contact.
Well, of course.
Haven't you found that out in your research?
Yes, it does seem to be the center of the universe as far as extraterrestrial craft goes and that means we're going to have more crashes here and more things, more events happening. And as far as we know, Holloman was, as far as we suspect, Holloman was kind of a clearinghouse for alien landings because it was so secure. They could come and go there without being shot at or looked upon. And the base at Holloman was extremely tight, And getting anybody from Holloman even today to talk is difficult. So they were a very close fraternity there at Holloman.
Have you spent any time in Holloman personally to try to find
out? No, I haven't. I did get a letter from the Air Force that said that Eisenhower's plane was sitting at Spence Air Force Base in Georgia for 5 days. And then,
they denied that it was ever in Holloman.
Right, yes, they denied it was ever there.
But you have evidence otherwise.
Well, I have eyewitnesses. It's always plain land. Right. Uh-huh. And he was expected at Holloman because they were going to do a parade for him where they stand at attention, you know, and guys are getting off the plane. And that was canceled by ahead of time, that there wasn't going to be a parade. But we did see him arrive, and had one guy, this airman, Kirtland, saw him take off. And we have secondhand witnesses then as to what transpired while he was.
This man we've interviewed, has he come forward? What are we calling him? Are we calling him his real name, or we have a?
It's similar to his real name,
okay.
But yeah, we're calling him Wilbur Kirkland.
Okay.
And at his request, but it's easier to talk.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Has he had any repercussions since this has come out?
No, he hasn't. He's a very cautious man, and he's had no repercussions because we're not using his real name. Now, I haven't been visited by the men in black yet either, although I am a little, every time I see a Mormon missionary come up the sidewalk, I wonder what's in that briefcase.
Yeah, this is a dark blue jacket, not black. So.
Okay.
Are you calling this the Eisenhower Project?
That's one of the names for it. His plane took quite a journey from Thomasville. In 1955, on July 9th to be exact, Eisenhower mentioned at a press conference that he had something of little interest to anybody in the room, but he and his family, that he was going hunting in Georgia for a few days. And went down to Secretary Humphrey, by the way, who was a Treasury Secretary in those days, who owned a plantation down near Thomasville, mm-hmm. Georgia. And he'd been there the year before, and they had apparently wonderful hunting. And they got all the limit of the birds and what have you and so forth. And so he was going back this year. Well, it's a strange time to go, Jerry, because the Red Chinese had started shelling Formosa.
Yes.
Today we know it as Taiwan, of course. And Eisenhower had promised to defend Formosa before he was elected in 52. And he told the international press that if they made any serious overtures toward invading Formosa, that we would use nuclear weapons. He didn't say bombs, but we were developing nuclear artillery shells and other things in those days that would be pretty formidable to come up against. And the whole world got upset at this statement that we were going to use nuclear weapons on Red Chinese if they invaded Formosa. Well, where was Russia in all this? Russia had just lost their first premier, Malenkov, after Stalin's death. Malenkov had been appointed mm-hmm. by Stalin to succeed him. And he hadn't worked out his five-year plan and what have you, and this was 1955, 2 years after Stalin's death. So the Russians were all on edge about a new leadership. And it's a funny time to go bird hunting, I'll tell you that, when the whole international situation is kind of on tether hooks. So some of the press decided to go bird hunting with Eisenhower. And they chartered a plane. There were 30 different people on that press plane. We had Time Magazine, Warner Path News, Life Magazine, New York Times, Christian Science monitored all the well-known papers of the day. And they were on this airplane, and they were going to stay with Ike to make sure if World War III broke out, they'd be nearby to get some news. They put them up at a place in Thomasville called the Scott Hotel. And it was kind of a news center, and every morning Presidential Secretary Hagerty would come in, give them a little briefing, and so forth and so on. And so when Ike got there, on the evening of the 10th, he went out bird hunting with just a few of his guys with him,
uh-huh.
and got a couple of birds. But it was starting to be drizzly cold. And that night, it went down to something like 20 above. Everything, the drizzle froze it to ice. And, of course, anybody in the audience that's ever done bird hunting knows if you're using dogs, they can't smell anything when it's iced over very well. So they said Ike went out the next morning and didn't do too well and had gone to the cottage, had the sniffles, and he and his valet were treating his sniffles. And he was drinking hot toddies and with Mamie by the fireside playing Scrabble. And the press thought that, well, we have a president that's ill. They're going to keep him indoors for a few days. And so they had taken with them 13 Secret Service agents on that trip. Normally they only take five. And one of the Air Force guys we contacted, Air Force One crewman, said that was the only time they ever remember that many Secret Service men. They didn't even have enough room for them in Eisenhower's plane. Some of them had to go on the press plane. And I said, why was that? He said, well, sometime back in the mid-50s, we assume this is the occasion.
Yeah.
They had taken Ike, went west, stuck out west from a hunting trip. They left the other five or six people there to pretend Ike was there. So he needed double Secret Service to pull off the ruse. And he got Perry DeHolliman about a quarter till nine on the morning of the 11th of February 1955. His plane taxied and down on the end of the runway and shut down. And we have an airman, airman Kirtland, who's going to give us some information about what transpired. We'll get ready
sure,
for that.
Sure, we have time for it, but let's take a break first so we don't interrupt it. We're going to get ready to hear some of the witnesses who saw Eisenhower at Holloman Air Force Base. Even though the press, they thought he was in Georgia. It's an interesting story for sure, Art. Don't go away.
Uncover the cover-up at the 2008 Amazing Roswell UFO Festival this July 3rd through 6th in Roswell, New Mexico. Absolutely everyone will be here. Find out the facts about UFOs and what governments really know and are covering up from more than 20 ufologists, experts, and authors. Experience fun, family-friendly entertainment at the Alien Village with ongoing music and out-of-this-world activities. Join us for the famous Alien Parade, costume contests, street dance, and sports tournaments. Don't miss the special screening of Roswell, the movie, with producer Paul Davids, the Daily Buzz newscast, a live broadcast by Cool 94.9, and sponsored by New Mexico CW My 50 TV, following the Roswell Sertoma Club's 4th of July fireworks extravaganza. The fun starts at opening ceremonies beginning at 9 o'clock a.m. on July 3rd, when you pick up your Shop Roswell passport. For more information about the 2008 Amazing Roswell UFO Festival, call 1-888-ROSFEST or visit www.ufofestivalroswell.com for complete schedule of events.
Art Campbell is our guest, and our subject is Dwight David Eisenhower, President of the United States in 1955. Did he meet ETs at the end of the runway at Holloman Air Force Base? Art, you have some witness testimony. I think we're ready to hear it.
Okay,
here
now our first segment will be when his friend Dorsey comes to the hospital where the airman's working. He's a high-altitude flight chamber specialist. And his supervisor had been out to the commissary with his wife and had seen a UFO hovering over the flight line at Holloman. And here is that information from Airman Kirtland.
So when I went to normal work the next morning, at about 8 o'clock, I walked into the flight surgeon's office, and I was asked by the nurse if I had seen Dorsey. And Dorothea Thorenson, who worked there, said, I saw him. She says, and he was going to the commissary with his wife. So I didn't think anything more of it, and I just went on. Dorothea was a clerk typist in the flight surgeon's
office.
Yes, a civilian. She was married, and she had a very nice car. I remember it was Oldsmobile Holiday. So when Chi said that he had come in later, I didn't think anything of it. When I went to coffee that day, but before I went to coffee, I saw Dorsey coming down the hall. He was an airman who was in charge of the men, the other airmen, at the flight center's office. And he said, "Bill, have you seen what's out there on the flight line?" And I'm thinking, you know, no, I haven't seen anything. He says, "You should go and see it." I says, "What is it?" He says, "It's a disc." When he said disc, I'm thinking a disc like we threw at college, you know, about this big, with a silver or stainless steel rim, wood, and...
The track discus that they use in track team.
Oh, yes, that was a track discus. Yeah. That's what I expected. He says, "No." I says, "What's it made out of?" He said, "Metal." And I said, "Oh, what's its color?" He says, "Silvery, you know, stainless polished steel, stainless steel or silver." And I said, "Well, how big is it?" I'm still thinking 12 inches or less. He said, 20 to 30 feet. I said, "What's it doing?" He says, "Hovering in the air." The only craft that I knew could hover was the hovercraft that the Navy was talking about building, flying pancake or flying flapjack, the hovercraft that would come in on off the shore, and a helicopter. And this wasn't any of those. So I said, "Well, I'll go and see it." He says, "It's out in front. Just go to the front of the hospital and take a look." So to do that, I had to ask permission. And I went up to the where an officer was being examined and knocked on the door, and the nurse came to it and said, I said, "Can I go to the front of the hospital and look down flight way?" And she looked at the doctor, and she said, "No." So I didn't
Okay.
Go.
Well, you ask a little bit about Kirtland's background, and he has a very impressive background. He's a high school graduate from Montebello, California, and joined the Air Force in 1952 and went to his basic training at Parks, which a lot of them did in those days. And he specialized in his training in high-altitude medicine and at Gunther Air Force Base in Alabama, where he did his training. And while he, after the Air Force, we can get into that a little bit later, but he did go to college and was quite had quite a name for himself. He went to Long Beach State College in applied math and minor physics. So we're talking about a pretty bright guy here.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he worked for North American Aviation in Burbank. Collins Radio in Newport Beach, Motorola Radio, and Lockheed Missile and Space in Houston. And he worked for NASA doing the trainers for the Apollo program. And he spent 24 years.
So he has quite a background.
Yes, 24 years in computers, plus his 9 years, four years in the military, sorry, 4 years in the military, gave him almost 30 years of government service. So he has quite a credible background.
Okay.
He went to coffee that morning. You want to hear this one?
Yeah. Well,
this is a great one, too. He went to coffee that morning and was walking behind a couple of officers who were talking about Eisenhower having landed that morning. And one of the guys that was ahead of him was the officer of the day, and most of us have been in the military. Remember, the officer of the day is the guy that checks, walks around, makes sure everybody's doing their job, right?
Right, right.
And he was in a blue uniform while everybody else on the base was in khakis. So that's how you can tell the OD's coming, if he's got a different uniform on usually. Now, I was always looking for a chief petty officer in a black uniform when I was in the Navy.
You in the Navy,
right?
Sure,
yeah,
sure, right.
Yeah. Well, we had them too. They came around too.
Yeah.
But anyhow,
I was in the Army. We had them.
Yeah, yeah. And so they talked about this officer of the day had been in the tower at Holloman when Eisenhower's plane landed, and talks about Ike and the UFO coming down in front of Eisenhower's plane. Let's listen to this. It will be really good.
Okay.
When I went on coffee break about 9 o'clock, 9:30, I came back from coffee and I was following two pilots. The one on the right was wearing blues and the one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, at Holloman during winter, normal work procedures, unless you were assigned official duties, was khakis. If you were assigned a job like officer of the day or something like that, or meeting somebody formally, you would wear blues. The man on the right was wearing blues. He was a second lieutenant. The one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, the one on the left was wearing khakis, and I heard them talking back and forth, and one of them said, "Did you see Air Force One?" I didn't know what Air Force One was. I had to ask later what it was, what it meant. And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Big Bird, isn't it?" He says, "Yes." And when he was talking about that, he said, "Well, what happened?" And the one on the right said, "I'm the officer of the day." He said, "What happened is they landed on the runway." He says, "And turned around and stayed on the active."
What does the word active mean?
Well, it means that's the runway that they're using to land and take off airplanes from.
And no other planes are allowed on.
No, not there. Not at that time. So he turned around on the active. He said, "We were told to turn off our radar." Well, after we shut off the radar, he says, they came over the mountains, over the White Sands Proving Ground and the monument. He says, "I heard," and the one on the left said, "I heard one landed at the monument."
Can you explain the monument?
The monument is White Sands Monument, and it's down the road from Holloman Air Force Base to the west.
It's an area, area?
It's a public park monument. And what he was saying was he had heard that one of them landed there. And the one on the right said, "I don't know whether that was true or not." He says, "I'm telling you what I saw. What I saw is one came overhead, two of them came over. One landed on the runway in front of them." He says, "And the other one hovered overhead 200, 300 feet. He said, "And what happened?" He said, "Well, he got out of the airplane and walked down, and he couldn't see the door opening on this craft because he didn't have binoculars." And then he said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "He went aboard the craft for 40 or 45 minutes. And
now, who was he?
The person who got out of Air Force One. It was his plane. So it had to be Eisenhower. Now, I didn't see this, but it just had to be Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is a very brave man, and he would have no problems going aboard a foreign UFO, if that's what it was, for 40 or 45 minutes.
I have a question here, Bill. Was there a gangway or something out that area?
So they probably had a ladder structure of some type.
At least as high as a basketball goal.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he came down and went aboard, walked to the craft and went aboard. He said, "Well, then what happened?" He says, "Well, when he got out, shook hands, and he walked off." And he went out of the airplane and walked back to his... He went out of their craft and walked back to his own airplane.
Well, there was one other time I asked him, I said, "Well, where did you see Eisenhower?" He said, "I didn't see Eisenhower." He said, "I saw his plane." But had a chance to go see a UFO, and then my doctor turned me down. Apparently the word was out that when the president gets here, it's business as usual, no gawking or anything like that. We want everybody to do business as usual. He's not coming to inspect the facilities. He's just coming for a visit. That was what the people were told a couple weeks before I came. So Airman Kirtland did his that duty that day and went back to his barracks and never got a chance to see Eisenhower. And finally somebody said, "Hey, Ike's plane's warming up. It's going to be taking off any minute. He's coming down the runway now." So all the guys in the barracks went running out to look at Eisenhower's plane. And Kirtland said he got out there just in time to see it fly over and turn off and towards the base housing. Now, no one flew over base housing. And he said the only guy who could get away with it was the president.
Mm-hmm.
Because, any accidents would be quite dreadful. So here's Airman Kirtland talking about that incident. It only goes about 30 seconds, but quite good.
Okay. I went to work, and after work, I was called out of my room in the barracks and ran out in the back, and Air Force One was flying overhead. Anyway, it flew over the residential area, and no airplane was allowed to turn and fly over the residential air force of the residential area of the Air Force base there because it wasn't safe. If they crashed, it would crash into these residents. So the only one that got away with it was Air Force.
Well, later on, Airman Kirtland's job, as far as we were able to determine, was that he wanted to make sure that the office, the medical office, was secured. And he saw some lights on over at the medical office, one of the offices, and from his barracks window, and decided to go over there and see what was going on. Well, he went in there and found his good friend, the Dr. Reiner, and a friend of his, a lieutenant colonel, who was also an officer of the day, wearing the blue uniform. And they're talking about Eisenhower speaking on the base that day. And apparently, there were several talks at least 400 people. So we thought it would be hard to find witnesses for this event, and it was difficult. But we also talking about civilians who weren't under any great secrecy. The military guys still are pretty mum about it. And we found two well-known military people, a Dr. Simons, who did the high-altitude balloon ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the people there at the base. And when we asked him about it, a friend of his asked him about it. He would not answer the question. That's strange. And the man's 98 years old now, and he still won't answer the question about something that happened 55 years ago.
Wow.
Then there was another one called, he was a very famous guy, Kittinger. Kittinger did the 102,000-foot parachute free-fall drop in 1960, which is still a record. Almost died doing it. We got a hold of Kittinger in Florida and said, do you remember, we never mentioned anything about aliens or UFO craft. Uh-huh. Do you remember Eisenhower visiting the base? And we had information ahead of time that Kittinger had lunch with Eisenhower. Well, Kittinger has a poor memory, we'll put it truthfully. He said, I don't recall Eisenhower being there. It must have been after I left. So some of your top brass were still want to perpetuate that myth that nothing happened. And we've heard that one before, haven't
mm-hmm.
we? And so we're going to hear the conversation now between Airman Kirtland and his boss, Dr. Reiner, over at the AeroMed lab after hours.
That night after supper, I looked at the flight surgeon's office, and one of my jobs is to check and make sure that the lights and everything was secure. I saw lights over there. So I went in the back way, and when I went into the back way, I was talking. I saw Captain Reiner talking to a lieutenant colonel who was dressed in blue. Reiner had his white coat-like, smock-like on. They were talking. The one, and the colonel said, I don't know about others. He said, well, I'm telling you what I saw. He said, I was standing on the stage with him. And Reiner spoke up and said, I heard that he spoke also at the base theater. He said he might have. He only spoke a couple of minutes at the one place. And then the base commander took over, and he spoke for about 20 minutes. So it was plenty of time for him to go from the supply hangar to the base, to the base theater and back again. He said, I'm telling you what I saw. Standing room only in the supply hangar, 225 men each time. He said, there might have been a third time. He said, but I wasn't there. And I said, who spoke? And the lieutenant colonel said, Commander-in-Chief. And I said, the President. And he said, the Commander-in-Chief. He repeated himself. Well, I know, and you know, that the Commander-in-Chief is the President.
Okay, you were asking earlier about other witnesses besides this one man.
Uh-huh.
We were able to find two.
Two witnesses. Art, let's take a break. We've got another half hour to go, folks. A riveting story about Eisenhower and his meeting on the runway at Holloman Air Force Base in Albuquerque, February 1955. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Rod C. Davis. I have a question. Do you love to travel? Then you need to check out YTB's weekly travel deals and steals. Just go to the Travel Store and More banner, click on the Business and Vacation Travel link, and then sign up for the Deals and Steals newsletter for great deals every week to America's favorite vacation spots. And while you're logged on, you can send flowers to that special person, buy your perfect car, buy tickets to attractions, book an exotic hunting or fishing trip, set up a honeymoon registry, and much more. Just click on the extras link and take advantage of YTB's huge purchasing power that saves you money. And if you'd like to save a lot of money on your travel, then check out the Travel Business Opportunity link and find out how you could earn a commission each and every time that you book a trip. You can be sure that Travelocity, Orbitz, and Expedia won't do that. Click on the banner and bookmark the page for your future use. You can save money.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Art Campbell, and we're talking about Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, visiting an ET at the end of the runway at Holloman Air Force Base back in 1955. Art, how about other witnesses?
We're able to find two. As a result of an article in UFO Magazine, I was contacted by a lady who lives in southeastern Nebraska. And she said her father was an electrician at Holloman and told a story about seeing what was a UFO at a later time. And he was there apparently in 1955, and they had just moved down there from Albuquerque. She was in the fourth grade, about 9 or 10 years old, and recalls Dad coming home saying that he'd had this experience, but at the time, the people there did not realize what UFOs were. Even at the top secret bases, the extraterrestrial thing was absolutely not even considered among the average average person. And so what he thought he saw was a German secret weapon that the paperclip guys who were working at Alamogordo in those days in the White Sands Missile Range had developed, and he thought maybe Eisenhower had come to see this secret innovation. Well, anyhow, his daughter here is going to be reading a letter that she found in her archives, and it's a family letter that's a classic. And they always had Dad tell this story whenever they had family reunions about the time Dad became a fireman. And the reason he became a fireman was when he saw that UFO, he got down that pole real fast. So we're going to hear this lady from, she lives in the area of Auburn, Nebraska, talking about her father, the electrician, and the day he became a fireman.
Letter's right here. I'm sure I'll find that one. Yeah, here's the one that Mom and Dad wrote. Okay, that's Auburn, Nebraska, October 26, 1989. Dear kids, it's beautiful fall here with the usual pumpkins up and down the main drag. Kids are getting excited. Your father and I are doing well. Heard from Helen. She said the grandchild came on time, and although Sharon was in labor, you don't need to talk about that. Anyway, Dad has just come from the kitchen with a cup of coffee, and he says he doesn't mind telling the fireman's story again, but you kids know it better after all these years. But he'll recall what he can. All right, this is the part. Well, you kids and Mom moved down from Albuquerque. I think it was in the summer of 1954. As you recall, I had taken the Hollerman job that previous winter, and Mom wanted us all together, so we rented a place over near Dudley Elementary School on Maryland, wasn't it? Remember, you kids could walk to school. You were in the fourth grade, and Billy was in first or second. Anyhow, sometime after Christmas of 55, we were told President Eisenhower was coming. So George, our boss then at the electric shop, went to a meeting to find out more. He would not be inspecting anything, and they said just carry on as usual. If you see the president, don't gawk, wave, or anything, just carry on. So the day the president came, we went out in the truck to a job where we were replacing some wire down the flight line. It was really old stuff, but it put there in World War II, and safe. So we heard the president's plane in the morning lining up for an approach and watched it land on the far runway. So we waited for it to taxi over to the flight line so we could see him. But we didn't hear it anymore, and it had shut down somewhere out there. So we went ahead and pulled wire for a while, and one of the men, I believe it was Charlie, said he can see out there from that pole over there. So why don't one of us go up the pole and see where the plane is? Well, I had my climbers on, and I started to unbuckle them and was waiting to give them to the first volunteer. When someone said I should do it, as people were used to seeing me up on the poles anyway. So I started up with my back to the sun, a safety measure, which also put my back to the runway where we thought his Connie was. Connie was a nickname for the big constellation the president flew. As I started up, some of the guys reminded me not to gawk, and I heard them laugh. A few minutes later, I heard some shouting, and some guys tarring a hangar roof nearby started to run, pointing out to the runways. Then I heard our truck start up, and some of the crew jumped in, with one or two running after it. And they were pointing out to the flight line, and so I decided to turn around on the pole to see what the ruckus was about, and I could not believe what I saw. There was this pie tin-like thing coming at me about 150 feet away. I thought it was remote-controlled or something. 25 to 30 feet across, and I started down the pole as fast as I could go. I was up about 40 feet, and I threw my climbing rope out, gave it slack, and only touched the spike on each side of the pole three or four times on each side in before I got to the bottom. While I was running towards the big hangar, I looked back, and it had stopped and was just sitting there. Well, when we all got back to the shop and we had a good laugh, one of the guys who saw me come down said he got down that pole faster than a fireman. So as you kids were growing up and we had the family gatherings, you used to ask to tell me about the time I became a fireman. You know, I always wondered why we did not use that thing during Vietnam and so forth. And over the years, I realized if we had technology like that, it would have saved lots of lives. But I gradually realized that it had something to do with Ike being there that day. And it wasn't ours. It was an unwritten rule at Holloman. You didn't talk about what you saw. And after that day, it was seldom mentioned at the shop. I still have those climbers here someplace. Billy used to play with them. You remember? Mom here again. Well, Dad's wandered outside someplace. He said something about checking the pump. It's been sluggish lately. Dad thinks the motor's old and needs rewinding. He spends several hours a week up at Harold's helping out with mechanical and electrical stuff for farm equipment. Dr. Fornash says it's okay for Dad to drive a little around town, but to keep an eye on him. He thinks Dad has had a mini stroke or two, but should not do any highway driving at night. He drags his left foot a little, but gets out to the golf course in good weather. But he has to use a cart now. We're looking forward to seeing all of you at Christmas. Say hi to Bob and Warren for us, and hug the twins. All of our love.
We had quite a few, a lot of interest in this, and as a result of a radio program we did back in in Southern Oregon, I got a call from a man. He said, "Well, I have a brother that lives down in Oakland, and he was in the B-29 pilot." Not a pilot, but a gunner. And he said, when he comes up, would you like to talk to him? He told me he saw the president once at an Air Force base. I certainly would like to talk to him. So the guy we're talking to here is, it's not his real name, but it's close. And he's talking about his experience. Well, let me give you his background. Staff Sergeant Wyckoff had been a 17-year-old enlistee into the Air Force during World War II. He was trained as a tail gunner in the B-29s. He saw 43 missions over Japan, was in on the low-level raids when they dropped incendiary bombs over Tokyo and practically burned the whole city down in one night, and was in on the battle of Okinawa. He can tell you when and where they went to do the bombing and where he was when the atomic bomb went off and so forth. He's quite a credible man. He's seen an awful lot of combat. I like to use combat veterans because generally they're pretty unassuming, and they really haven't got they don't tell stories usually.
Mm-hmm.
The real ones don't. So, anyhow, to set the base up here, the thing up here, Sergeant Wyckoff was running freight out of Vacaville Air Force Base in Indiana. And he was to deliver some material to Holloman Air Force Base on the 10th of February, 1955. And later on, we'll tell you how we happen to know the date. And they arrived, got their freight unloaded, and they were due to leave the next morning, which is what they usually do. You spend the night at the enlisted barracks, and the officers go to the officers' club. And they were told to report down to the flight area, and their plane will be ready at about 9 o'clock the next morning. So they got down there about 8:30, checked things over, and the officer down there at the flight area said that the flight had been canceled and that we sent your lieutenant back to the officers' quarters, and that they want you to, we can't let the flight take off because we just closed the airport, closed the runway. This is a very long runway at Holloman, and they closed it. And so he said, well, why? He said, well, President Eisenhower is coming in a few minutes, and we don't want any planes taking off or revving up the motors or what have you as long as the president is here. Well, how long will he be here, the staff sergeant? Well, we're not sure, but we're going to close this runway, and you guys might as well go on back to barracks. You stay here if you want to. His plane's coming in now. So he sees Air Force One land at Holloman Air Force Base and taxi down and stop at the far end of a runway. And we found out earlier why he had stopped, because they wanted to be as far away from the people as possible. So when the UFOs came in, they would not be around a lot of people. And so they put them at the far end of the runway. Well, probably Eisenhower had this whole trip set up to come to Holloman to meet the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to make sure it was in a secure place. It was in a secure base, that's for sure. And out on the end of the runway, not many people could see what was going on out there, except unless you had binoculars. Then I understand the door of the UFO was facing the sagebrush. You couldn't see a whole lot there. But, yeah, we heard earlier where some of the officers had said I was walking down the between the Air Force One and the UFO. I found this all hard to believe myself until I started talking to all these people and they start to fall together. In any case, here's Sergeant Wyckoff and what he observed and what he heard on that day, February 11th, 1955.
While I was out in Indiana, my job was loading and delivering a cargo. We went to Washington, where they opened a new base with cargo, and just kind of anything they wanted, we would fly it.
What other bases did you go to?
Well, I went to March and Holloman two or three times. We hauled what we think is stuff for the atomic bomb.
Dave, what do you recall about Holloman?
Well, we had a load of stuff down there, parts that they needed, and the runway is like this, and I never seen anything like that before. And anyway, as we were there, we saw Air Force One come in. And we didn't know who it was. And then we come, an officer come around and says, "You can't leave." And I says, "Well, the pilot said we have to leave." And he says, "Well, President Eisenhower's here, and you can't leave the field until he's gone." And I says, "You can hear him over loudspeakers, but it didn't do any good, you know. I would have liked to have seen him." And this officer, we didn't have the clearance to go into the mess hall. And one of the other officers, a higher-ranking officer, came to us and says, "Would you like to go in and eat and listen to a speech?" And most of us said, "Yeah, because I'd like to see him." I didn't get to shake his hand or anything, but because I didn't have the right badge, clearance, to go in. But they did leave us go in at the very end, and we ate and listened to his speech.
What do you think of him?
I thought he was great. He had a lot of good ideas. Maybe he had some I disagreed with, but I don't agree with everybody anyway, you know.
Dave, you remember what date that was that you were there?
The reason I know it, when he was there, is here's what I got discharged. He was there in mid-February in 1955. That was my last trip that I made while I was in the service. Then I was discharged, and I came back home to the Bay Area with my family.
In interviewing Sergeant Wyckoff in Oakland, I went down twice. It's about an eight-hour drive from my home in Southern Oregon.
Portland.
Yeah.
No,
Oakland, California, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's from the Bay Area.
Okay.
Originally. So we had to check and make sure somebody's just not pulling our leg, you know. And I said, "How did you know that it was the 9th or 10th of February, 1955? He said, "That was my last trip." And he pulls out his discharge. And it says, "Honorably discharged, February 22nd, 1955. He told me he was discharged about 10 days later. Mm-hmm. He pulls out his discharge. And we've made a video of this, by the way. And there it is, February 22nd, mm-hmm. 1955. So here's a man that was not under any great secrecy because he was from another air base. But they wouldn't let him in to see Ike initially because he didn't have the right badge on. But he did get to hear him and one of the other talks.
Art, we have to take a break, but when I come back, you've got to tell our audience about what this man, Arthur Godfrey, has to do with President Eisenhower in the flight to Holloman Air Force Base.
Let's have another cup of Lipton tea.
Lipton tea and Lipton soup present Arthur Godfrey and his talent scout.
It seems like
Thank you, George Bryan, Peggy Marshall in the Holidays, Archie Blyer in the orchestra, and a special welcome to you folk who are kind enough to come to the studio tonight.
Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know, and I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at MarvelousMarv.com.
This is London.
Tonight, London is a city of song and celebration and thanksgiving. There are fireworks and parties. Air raid shelters are as remote as the covered wagon. Many words have been spoken and much drink has been consumed. London has been somewhat hysterical and still is. The organized killing has ended in Europe. The young men of many nations have suffered, sacrificed, and achieved victory. The coming months and years will reveal what will be done with that victory.
Edwin R. Murrow and Arthur Godfrey, President Dwight David Eisenhower, ETs on a runway at Holloman Air Force Base. They're all connected somehow, right, Art?
Jerry, you asked about the passenger list. We were able to get the passenger list of this airplane from Flight 58 from the Eisenhower Library at Abilene, Kansas. And it is extraordinary. Of course, there's Secretary Humphrey on there with Ike's hunting party, Mrs. Dowd, Amy's mother, one or two other people, a Garden Carter, some other people that hunted with Ike usually. About six or seven people were in the hunting party. Well, going on down the list, number 17 was Arthur Godfrey.
Well,
what's he going to do, a soft shoe in the aisle with a ukulele, you know?
Put him on talent scouts.
Right, put him on, let him entertain them while they're going to their one-hour flight down to Georgia. And that, I said, well, Arthur Godfrey, is this the real one, you know? Well, it turned out it was the real one. And we were able to find out from a website called ConnellRad. I recommend it to you, some of your listeners. They deal solely with information that went on during the nuclear scare in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So great website. And apparently CBS had two well-known people, Edward R. Murrow and Arthur Godfrey, that were retained by the government to make commercials, and not a commercial, but to make it a public service announcement in case we were attacked by nuclear war, and said everything is okay, folks. So here's grandfatherly voice, Arthur Godfrey, and many of your listeners will remember how what a golden voice he had.
Right.
Remember the day. And then there's Edward R. Murrow.
Right.
We all know, our generation knew Edward R. Murrow, mm-hmm. and they know it for many generations to come. He was the famous CBS broadcaster from This Is London.
Yes.
World War II.
You're remember? Right.
Yes. Well, they had taken both of these voices and put them on tape. By the way, the tapes have not been found. But Frank Stanton, who was
the president
of CBS, yes, said in several interviews before he died in 2006 that they had recorded both Godfrey and Edward R. Murrow to make an announcement in case we had been attacked by nuclear bombs, that the president, that the government was alive and well, and they had built these huge facilities down at down in the south, it's maybe 25, 30 minutes from Washington. One down at the Greenbrier Inn was one,
yes. mm-hmm.
and we've seen them on TV in various places, and huge underground facilities. Now, while we were all groveling around in the dark and under house shelters, here was our government doing well down there in some of these very opulent motels. And, of course, they had blast doors 6 feet thick, and it was absolutely incredible. Well, let's get back to why would we have Arthur Godfrey, who was not a social guest, on Eisenhower's personal plane? Your guess is as good as mine. But maybe they were afraid that war would break out, and they'd have a spokesman with them.
Yeah, they didn't have the Formosa thing going on at
that point. Oh, why? It was in those, for us at the time, it was as close to the nuclear war as we've ever seen. Now, of course, 1960 was a little closer with Kennedy. But this was close because the Russians and the Chinese were very upset. And
the press and CBS never told CBS News that Arthur Godfrey was on that plane.
Well, Arthur Godfrey made many trips on that plane. I found out from the Air Force One personnel. Yes. They even had a seat.
So it wasn't unusual.
No, a seat reserved for him back in the crew quarters. He liked the inside back corner of the window.
Yeah, he was a pilot.
He had been a pilot,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, at one time.
Yes, the pilot.
And so he was quite interested in
the Coast Guard for years during the Navy. and was quite an interesting man. And now, of course, Murrow wasn't on the flight, but we were able later to find out that Murrow from through Stanton that Murrow had been advised. But that website, Conrad, talks about these various things. There was an article in Time magazine, I believe August of 1992, that told all about what the government had planned in case of nuclear war. The facilities, where they were, what they did. And we had, I don't know, 15,000, 20,000 people that were going to go underground immediately if they didn't get blown away to various places to keep the government working. And this is something Eisenhower had decreed about 1954 or 55. We've got to have a place for our government people if we have nuclear war so we can function, still function as a country. And I could not believe Arthur Godfrey's name was on that list.
Yeah, now, that's amazing.
You know, this is much more important than UFO than Holloman, the country going up in a mushroom cloud. And
sure.
What we were going to do about it, you know, Washington, D.C. It's amazing, amazing story.
So when we talk about all of this, the question I have, Art, and maybe there's no answer to it yet, who are these ETs? Who were they? Are they still around?
Our best information that I've been able to glean from various sources indicate that these ETs that Eisenhower, by the way, Eisenhower was only aboard that craft for 40 or 45 minutes, so you're not going to do much with a new race of people in 40 or 45 minutes. So it made me think that there was some business going on that was transacted there. Were they saying, lay off of the Red Chinese, don't use your nukes? Or were they saying, hello and have a cup of coffee? I doubt it. It sounds to me like 45 minutes is too short for a social occasion.
Yeah, just kind of a time for a message.
It's too long to be chewed out.
Yeah, ultimatum, sort of.
So I think there was some negotiations going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on an angle. Can I mention my website?
Sure. Yeah.
I have the 7-part series done for Fireless Files on this Eisenhower thing on my website, which is www.artc@conpoint. I'm giving my email here. Let's try it again. www.ufocrashbook.com.
And we have a link to that.
Right, we have a link to that. So they'll be able to read all about the Eisenhower thing and the book that we've written on the crash at San Augustine. But back to your question on the aliens. It's our belief that these aliens that met Eisenhower at Holloman, and I'm not sure what the ones did at Edwards the year before, if there was a meeting, there may very well have been, were behind the peace process that started at Geneva that July. That eventually led to peace between the Soviet Union and the United States. At least we had peace for the major powers had peace. And I think eventually the peace kind of wore the Russians down and they collapsed.
So I may be stretching a little bit, but the hypothesis here is the aliens showed up and they may have done the same thing with behind the Iron Curtain as well. And
we're looking in to see if there was any alien
intervention.
Contact.
Right, intervention for peace.
Intervention for peace. Now, that's good news. That somebody is thinking that well of us and wants us to, wishes us that well, and is willing to get involved in it. I think that that meeting Eisenhower had on the tarmac, on the runway there at Holloman, very well could have been to encourage him to go and support that peace process or report to how other people were doing about it.
Maybe we can find out what was happening in the Soviet Union at the same time. That's going to be a little tougher, but...
Well, I've been talking to George Knapp, and he said that since Premier Putin got in, that the UFO things were pretty well closed down there. They were open for a while.
Yes.
So we're working other angles. There were some, the nationalist Chinese were there, as well as the Red Chinese, and we had Russia, France, and all the powers that had divided Berlin were there. We had Russia, France, United States, and Britain there, about 10 of the major world powers. We hope maybe we could find a window somewhere and see if we can work on this hypothesis that this may have been the beginning of a peace process.
Art, thanks very much.
Thank you.
What an incredible show. Thanks to everyone who put it together. Jane Swartley, our web producer. Roberta Scott, our on-location producer. Nick Redfern is with us, and Nick, we keep crossing paths.
We do.
You're a busy man.
Yeah, I try and keep busy and, do a lot of research, magazine articles, books, etc.
You spoke here on a thing called Project Moondust, and we'll talk about that here in just a second. I guess Ryan Wood and you're together collaborating on a book about this subject, huh?
Yeah, Moondust's an interesting story. The basic scenario of it is that, if UFO crashes occur, are the recoveries just handled randomly by, the nearest military unit, or is it kind of like a crash retrieval team that goes out? And so myself and Ryan are putting all this material together.
What did you find out?
Well, there's quite a bit of documentation being released on Moondust, which does talk about the so-called quick reaction units responding to incidents that in some cases do sound like UFOs. One in Bolivia in 1978, where some documents have surfaced on this case, talks about the recovery and crash of a 15-foot diameter egg-shaped object in the Bolivian mountains. And this doesn't sound like a satellite or rocket debris or anything like that. It does sound far stranger. And we found some policy documents on Moondust which talk about how, they explicitly use the term UFO in terms of what they're looking to recover. And it talks about how the personnel on the projects were trained in quick reaction techniques, how to get in, to get out, secure crash sites, that sort of thing. So it does look like this is some sort of crash retrieval unit.
Now, you mentioned Bolivia. Mm. Are we talking about the U.S. government going into other countries and recovering this stuff?
Yeah, there's an interesting document from 1961 that actually states that Moondust personnel will be trained to go in and recover items, as they call them, of extreme intelligence and technological interest. And it actually states regardless of location. So they're quite clearly looking, under cover of night or whatever, parachute the guys in and secure the site, no matter if it's, America, South America, Africa,
wherever,
if they can conceivably get in and get whatever's there and bring it back.
It's interesting that the United States seems to get cooperation from everybody on this issue. You would think somebody say, hey, you can't come in here.
Well, there have been rumors that, people have said, for example, with the Bolivian case, there's no doubt that the Americans took a lot of interest in that and went out there. But the official story of the Bolivian government is, sorry, we didn't find anything. So in that case, it might well be that the Bolivians did withhold whatever it was they found, despite the fact that there were people from NASA and Moondust out there. Maybe they didn't actually get cooperation on that one.
Well, you're an interesting fellow. You've written some books. For instance, the Roswell book, where you took the other issue that nothing really happened. What do you really feel? Are you still not about Roswell, but about all of this?
I think when it comes to UFOs, people want you in the believer camp or the skeptic camp.
Mm-hmm.
For me,
I'm trying to find out where you're camped.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't really camp anywhere. I think it's more from the perspective that I think it's important that because, I always say to people, the U in UFO it still stands for unidentified, and I think it's the onus is on us to put all the information out for people to see. I think the only way we're going to resolve the UFO mystery is to look at all the evidence, not just the evidence that we want to hear about. And that's the only reason I put the Roswell book out, was purely and simply to say, hey, this is what other people are saying. Can we verify it, or is it disinformation? And that's the same with Moondust. I'm putting the book out, or the information out, to people to say, this is what we've uncovered, and here it is. So, for me, there's no doubt in my mind that there's a genuine UFO mystery. I think part of it is based around probably classified military aircraft, a small percentage. And I think there's a small percentage that also, when you get rid of the hoaxes and the misidentifications, there's a genuine UFO mystery where something is visiting us. I don't know if it's extraterrestrial, interdimensional, what it is, but there's something here.
So you're still open to the whole subject?
Oh, I'm convinced that there's a genuine... We have visitations from something, yeah.
But
I think there's several different strands. I don't think the UFO mystery will be solved by one thing. I think some cases will be shown to be classified weird military aircraft. Others will be genuine UFOs.
Yeah, where was moon dust based out of?
Well, it was based at Fort Belvoir in Virginia.
Virginia.
And it was housed there throughout its time from when it was set up in the mid-50s through to the 1980s.
So it was that early?
Oh, yeah, mid-50s to the 80s. And what happened after that was that it still exists in some form today, but it has a new classified name.
They renamed the name.
Yeah, and we don't know what
that
name is.
You don't have a clue?
No, they will not release that name.
Were they cooperative at all on moon dust?
Well, to an extent. I mean, there's probably about 900 pages of documents have now been released into the public domain on moon dust. Most of the reports fall into the category of recoveries of things like Soviet rocket material, satellites, because that was another role that moon dust had.
Right, right. We were like Keksberg, for instance.
Yeah.
There was a big rumor that it was a Soviet satellite. I don't know whatever really was decided.
Yeah. But some of the reports are more intriguing. As I said, like the Bolivian one. And there's some in the, there's one from the 1960s, 1965, where an object exploded over the Congo. And moon dust personnel got hold of some of the fragments.
Oh, Tarzan's territory.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow, what happened there?
Well, what happened was that there's the CIA have declassified a document that was forwarded to moon dust and that talks about the crash of this object that actually exploded in the sky. And that I don't think they recovered the whole thing. They got fragments of it. But they were sent back for an analysis. And one or two documents on this case have surfaced, but unfortunately we don't have anything too substantial, and that's one of the problems in a lot of these cases, that we hear rumors and whistleblower testimony, but actually getting hold of the hard files is a bit difficult.
Do you have any hunch or educated guess about where some of this crash retrieval material might be?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Moondust files, they talk about how they liaise very closely with the foreign technology people at Wright-Patterson. So I think what it seems to be is that the Moondust people are based out of Fort Belvoir. They would be the guys who would go out and recover the material. They would then liaise and send it to the Foreign Technology Department people at Wright-Patterson. And so, you know, we hear these tales about...
Wright-Patterson was at least a major player
back
in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably still, don't know.
No, I'm sure to an extent that, you know, maybe a lot of it's been transferred out now. I don't know. But certainly... In the 60s and 70s, Wright-Patterson was a big player in the moon story.
Did you get a hunch that there was a lot of back engineering going on this stuff? Or were most of the crashes not that complete? In other words, just debris?
Well, the documents talk about... they don't talk about back engineering, but they do talk about how we need to get hold of this material so we can examine it for, you know, our scientific advancements. So it was quite clear they're looking to determine how exotic technologies work and we need to get our hands on them and see what we can do with them, which is kind of like leading towards back engineering.
Yeah, you know, we hear all kinds of stories. Any evidence in the Project Moondust research that you did about anyone getting injured or hurt or killed?
Not really. I mean, there are some cases, you know, where they've reported that some of the retrieval teams have died of weird illnesses or radiation exposure. And they kind of...
Did you see some evidence?
No, not in the files. But they do kind of sound like Moondust teams, you know, these quick reaction teams. Now, you know, in certain cases, people said, yeah, some of the retrieval members died, but they didn't mention Moondust by name, but it sounds like a Moondust operation.
Now, you mentioned Fort Belvoir. That's an Army post. Was this an Air Force operation or an inter-service thing or what?
Yeah, I mean...
Or was it all civilians?
No, Moondust actually involved the Army, the Air Force, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and with overseas cases, they would liaise with the State Department to try and get permission from other countries where there was a State Department office to go in there.
So there is evidence that we did at least notify the countries.
I mean, there may well have been cases when they didn't, but they did try where possible to have like a diplomatic question, you know, can we come into your country and see what this is?
How did you get this material? Basically, freedom of information?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just innocuous stuff, satellite materials. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every sort of 20, 30 pages, you'll find some interesting ones. And I do sometimes wonder...
There's always a little nugget there.
I do sometimes wonder if they just didn't... The declassifiers wondered if there wasn't really anything of interest there and just said, yeah, put it out, not realising that there were a few nuggets.
Yeah, in other words, they didn't read it all either.
Yeah, they couldn't be bothered.
the latest clerks.
Yeah, I think that happens occasionally, you know, these declassification
people. Well, yeah, that would be the eternal hope of every researcher, I imagine. Oh. And I guess it does happen.
You find occasionally it does. I think, you know, you find a declassification person who overlooks something, and that opens a little door to something else. So.
I wonder if there's any ramifications on that.
There could be. I mean, maybe when they realize they've released something, unfortunately, that might then prompt them to shut down even further.
They probably wouldn't want to tell someone.
No.
If they could get out of it.
Yeah.
You know, this whole subject, you've been involved in this for, a couple of decades almost.
Yeah, I mean, I got interested. My father was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and he was involved in tracking UFOs on a couple of occasions.
Oh, you actually saw some blips that couldn't identify?
Yeah, they tracked them. They sent planes up. Everybody was sworn to secrecy and told not to talk about it. And when my dad told me this, that's what really got me interested. And so that's what, you know, when you meet someone who, like your father, who's trained in radar, then you realize that there are weird things flying around. So.
And why do you think we have the situation of the cover-up to begin with? Is it because of safety issues?
Well, you know, I think maybe in the early years it was, we don't know what's going on, so we won't say anything.
Yeah, in the Cold War.
Yeah, and I think today it probably is related to the idea of trying to get new technologies that they don't want to fall into enemy hands. And so the best way to prevent the enemies finding out is not to tell anyone anything. So.
Just mum is the word.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you've got a book out about Bigfoot, is that right?
Yeah, I've got my other interest other than UFOs is cryptozoology, and I've got a new one called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, which is like a five-year trek around the U.S. and Puerto Rico looking for lake monsters, the chupacabras, Bigfoot.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back. And if you you have anything else you'd like to add about UFOs, got anything, breaking stories you can tell me?
I guess for the most part, I've just been sort of focusing on the moon dust stuff recently, you know, trying to determine if these are the guys who, you know, we need to pursue further, which I think they are.
Nick Redfern is our guest, and we're going to talk about cryptozoology when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. Hey, check out the UFOTV.com section when you get a chance. They have an ebook section now. Now, this ebook section offers PDF files for download, and basically, it's hard to find books that are out of print, articles in magazines that are rare, that people can't find anymore, magazines that even collectors can't find. They've managed to take all of this at UFOTV and make it available to you. You could spend a whole day there at that website shopping. You know, of course, everybody thinks of UFO TV basically as conspiracy and UFO DVDs, and they certainly do that. There's no doubt about that. And it's probably the best place wherever you are in the world. We have about 35% of our audience out of the United States, and it doesn't make any difference where you are. If you can get connected, then you can get these DVDs shipped to you, or if you prefer, you can get them as a download. Here's a number to call for that new catalog, 1-800-350-4639. I'll give it to you again in a minute if you want to get something to write down. Or you can go to ufotv.com and check it out, 1-800-350-4639. Nick Redfern, tell me a little bit about cryptozoology. Mm. I mean, I'm interested in that, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, cryptozoology is my other big interest aside from
UFOs. And we're talking about weird, unexplainable things of nature. And many of them are, most of them are, can be attributed to, either freaks of nature or leftover evolution things.
Yeah, I think, you know, it broadly covers everything from, like, the Loch Ness Monster, sea serpents, Bigfoot, the chupacabras. And I think some of these, at least, are probably creatures that have survived extinction, perhaps from the prehistoric era, particularly sea serpent-type reports and lake monsters and things like that.
Yeah, what in your book, what can we expect to find there? You have them in sections, or you tell stories, or
yeah, I mean, there's different chapters and different ones. I've made two trips to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabras. I've spent about a month out there altogether.
Okay, we all hear all kinds of stories about those down in Puerto Rico. Yeah. Did you see one?
I didn't see one, no, but I spoke to a lot of people who did. And
I guess they can jump 30 feet or so?
Well, most of the people actually just reported seeing these things in the fields, killing animals, and described them as being like a monkey-like body with large bat-like wings and glowing eyes, sort of really weird-looking creatures.
Why do you... They seem to be more common. Maybe I'm wrong on this. If I am, you can correct me, but it seems to be more common in Central and South America, all of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, it began largely in Puerto Rico, and then you get reports in Florida, and it was almost as if it was moving, and then Mexico, and then down to Chile, Argentina, and places like that. So either it's moving or it's spreading, one of the two. So.
Well, what do you... think that we're really talking about here?
I truthfully don't know. I mean,
is it like the Spanish word bloodsuckers? Is that what
yeah,
they do?
Yeah, I mean, all the reports that I found on the island when I went there, you know, people described animals drained of blood, almost like a classic two puncture marks on the neck.
A vampire type.
Yeah, but the people over there were kind of in different opinions depending on who you spoke to. Some thought it was connected with the fact that there's a lot of UFO activity on the island. Some people were talking about weird genetic
experiments. Yeah,
in fact,
the story for several years was, hey, these are UFO pets.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a bit simplistic. But
yeah.
I'm not sure the pets just taking them for a walk.
Yeah, right, and they got away.
Yeah, but I mean, no, a lot of people do think they're kind of some genetic experiments, either an alien one or a government one. Other people on the island saw them.
Any
like
evidence of government things doing?
Only rumors and stories.
Yeah.
But other people thought they were kind of like a paranormal creature, supernatural.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different theories depending on who you speak to.
Because nobody, as far as I know,
nobody's caught
has
one,
a
yeah.
corpse.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, you know, it causes a lot of superstition.
Same thing with Bigfoot.
Yeah.
What do you think, they bury their own or what?
Well, you know, I mean, again, it's one of these mysteries that, why don't we find a body or anything like that? And again, that makes some people think, are these paranormal? Are these supernatural and rather just a flesh and blood
ape? Yeah, well, there have been a lot of reports of Bigfoot around UFO sightings,
too. Yeah, there's a lot. So, you know, I think some of these things are flesh and blood animals, like sea serpents, lake monsters. Others, I'm not so sure that they might sort of straddle two areas, you know, maybe semi-physical, semi-paranormal in some way. And I think that's why they avoid capture.
The sea monsters, of course, with the Loch Ness Monster and all the other things, you know, that's been the thing of movies as well as Bigfoot and other creatures. Mm-hmm. But what about the Loch Ness? Is something there?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, Loch Ness is a very large body of water. It's 22 miles long, a mile wide, and at its deepest point...
And it's very deep,
At its deepest point, it's almost 1,000 feet deep. So it's huge. And so the idea that, you know, a colony of creatures could live there isn't that out of the ordinary. And if they breathe, they take oxygen from the water, they probably don't have to surface that often. So the chances of seeing something 15 foot long in a 22-mile body of water that breathes underwater like a fish, the chances of seeing it aren't very...
good
chances.
It wouldn't be very good.
No, and I think also what a lot of people forget is that if this is a water-breathing animal, when they die, they just sink to the bottom. Their corpse won't come, you know, float to the top. It's going to sink to the bottom, and it's going to get eaten by the other creatures in the loch. So, you know, that's what nature
does.
Yeah,
that's the way it works.
Yeah, so, you know, again, the chances of finding a body after death aren't very high, really. So.
Now, do you have any examples of a man being impacted by one of these sea monsters? I mean, have they come on board a ship or something?
Not so much on board, but there are some old records I found in some of the British Royal Navy files that talk about how they saw these huge serpents and they came very close to the ship. And, you know, the crew were concerned that there was going to be a collision. There wasn't, but there are reports of, you know, this huge monstrous thing came within 20 feet of the ship.
Yeah, I have visions of it, part of it in the water, part of it out.
Yeah, that's right, like a serpent and the neck coming up and humps and things like that. Yeah.
But no reports that you found where somebody captured something that...
There are a few reports. The problem is most of the reports where people captured something or it was washed up on the shore were like 100, 200 years ago. And we've got a few photographs of weird things from 100 years ago, 50 years ago. But unfortunately, the people, you know, just local villagers, didn't bother trying to preserve the evidence, and it just rotted away, and we just don't really know what they were. That's the problem. So.
Now, what's the most unusual animal you found in cryptozoology research, and maybe you write about in your book?
I think one of the strangest is probably people who said they've seen so-called real-life werewolves. You get a lot of people who say they see what look like werewolf-type creatures, like giant man-like creatures with wolf-like faces.
Does that happen basically in this country or in Eastern Europe?
Or? Eastern Europe, England, America, South America, you get a lot of these reports. And they become, some people call them werewolves, other people call them dogmen. They get different names, you know, depending on the folklore of the area that exists. So they're strange ones.
Yeah, now most of the werewolf stories, literally the werewolf, changes from a man.
Yeah, now most of the reports aren't like that. They're just of like a very large wolf-like creature. But some people have said it seems to be able to walk on 4 feet and 2 feet, like a bear, but for longer periods. And that's not necessarily out of the ordinary. There were, up to probably about 500,000 years ago, there were some very, very large types of wolves that existed in the United States. I mean, almost like the size of a tiger or a lion. Huge predatorial wolves, and they became extinct. But some people wonder if maybe in some of the bigger forests they didn't become extinct, and perhaps these could be the source of some of these legends.
So this is really a worldwide phenomenon. Everything that we're talking about here today, including the UFO thing, but... Bigfoot, let's get back to that. A lot of people are interested in Bigfoot. Any reports of Bigfoot doing any damage to humans?
Not for the most part. For the most part, it seems to be like with gorillas. You know, they put on a show of force. You know, if you're faced with a Congo mountain gorilla, they'll charge you for the most part, but they won't attack. They'll back off at the last minute and beat their chests. But it's a show of force. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Bigfoot reports, you hear them throwing rocks at people and screaming, and it's almost as if it's an intimidation rather than a physical attack. So
how do you attribute to that? I guess they're not... predators from the sense of grabbing humans and eating them.
No, I mean, most of the...
They may be vegetarians.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think, you know, if you talk about a creature that's 7 feet tall, weighing 500 pounds, it's got to take in a lot of food. And if they were killing deer or animals in the woods all the time, I think we would see a lot more evidence of broken carcasses and things. I think the likelihood is that they probably are vegetarian, or maybe they just, you know, eat whatever they can find.
And maybe they eat it all.
Eat it all, just don't leave any traces, maybe, I don't know. I guess if you're in the wild, you know, you've got to take what's there.
So you don't really think of the Bigfoot as being a danger to man, or we just don't
know? I would think only in the sense if it was cornered. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, it would be defensive.
I mean, if you corner an 8 foot tall ape, it's gonna you're gonna come off worse.
If an ape comes down to that,
we're not gonna win.
have you talked to anybody who claims they've ever tracked down a Bigfoot and tranquilized it or found it when it was dead?
No, I mean, there are historical reports where there's a famous story, a guy named Albert Ostman, who said he was actually carried off by one of these things into what was like a little valley where these creatures supposedly lived, and he escaped.
Was it?
This was in Washington State a very long time ago, in the 20s.
Bigfoot country, right?
Yeah.
But it's actually a misnomer because Bigfoot seems to be in Pennsylvania and Arkansas and wherever.
Texas, even in some of the big thicket woods of Texas, which is sort of a few hours from where I live, they get reports even there. It seems anywhere there's large forest land, swamps, you get legends of these sorts of things out there. You know, the skunk ape in Florida and things like that. So
you know, we're going to have to wrap this up here in a minute, but you know, every time I talk to you, I get infatuated with the whole idea of cryptozoology. Even though most people think of you as a UFO man, you do other things too. We talked the last time about you writing some things about Hollywood celebrities.
Yeah, I do a lot of books on different subjects. I suppose to people in the UFO subject, I'm known for those. But I like to do cryptozoology, and I've had, as you mentioned, had a book earlier this year called Celebrity Secrets, which is a study of the way in which the FBI used to watch famous Hollywood stars like Marilyn Monroe.
In Roswell, we talked about that, because and they can hear that show on our website. I guess we decided in that conversation, Nick, and if I got it wrong, tell me, but it seems the FBI would rather watch Frank Sinatra or Marilyn Monroe than Joe Blow.
Yeah. I mean, they kept anybody who was famous in the Hollywood world, and it was mixing with people like the Kennedys and you know the Mafia. They watched all those sorts of people, and they watched their friends and watched their friends.
Well, in your Celebrity Secrets, did you discuss the Robert Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe murder mystery?
I did, yeah.
And what do you draw from that?
Well, I think she was either murdered or was allowed to die. You know, they found her and it was, well, let her die, and then there's no questions going to be brought up again. I think it was something along those lines.
Yeah. Anything else that you'd like to bring to our audience before you go to your next? I mean, you're all over the place, but you are close to me. I'm in Oklahoma. You're in Dallas.
Yeah, not far away.
Yeah. Anything else that you've run across here at this conference?
Well, I think for me the most interesting thing about the conference is that, you know, a lot of the cases we're talking about, we are beginning to get documents. People are speaking on the record. It's not just anonymous sources where we're not able to track them down. And I think that's good that there's teams of people around the world now actively looking into these cases and getting things done. So
it seems that, of course, a lot of retired people from not only our government, but France and England and Russia, are coming forward now, disclosure.
I think that's the important thing. When you've got people, you know, of rank and credibility, I mean, a lot of credible witnesses that just don't have, you know, the ranking or whatever, and they've got great cases. But when you talk about, you know, colonels and people in the military coming forward and high-ranking people, that gets the media's attention, and I think that opens a few doors for us as well.
Is there a penalty for talking about this stuff? I guess there is. Most of them are sworn to secrecy.
Well, there is, but then again, if you speak out and you're punished, then that proves that you're speaking truthfully. So I think the best thing...
It's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, I think when people do speak out, the government just hopes the controversy will go away.
I'm going to use that as an angle when I talk to some of these experiencers.
Yeah.
Say, hey, they're not going to do anything to you.
No, they won't for the most part, because then that just proves what you're saying is real. So.
Nick Redfern, tell us the name of that book on cryptozoology again.
That's called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, and it just recently published last month.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed
seeing you again. Thank you.
We have and Ruben Yonte and Noe Torres, and it's Mexico's Roswell, right? Is that the way we refer to the book?
Mexico's Roswell is the title of our book, and the subtitle is The Chihuahua UFO Crash. And we call it that because that's how it's commonly referred to among UFO investigators, both here in the U.S. and abroad.
Now, how do you gentlemen live in the same place, or
no?
How did you guys get together?
It's a very interesting story, and Ruben will pitch in here in a minute. But I was writing a book basically about Texas UFO sightings, and I had collected a number of Texas UFO incidents that have occurred over the past few decades. One of them that I had, and I was planning to do just a short chapter on it, was this incident that happened along the Texas-Mexico border in August of 1974, which ended up being the basis for this book. But, you know, early on in my research, it was just going to be a minor part of a larger book. Well, then I, while doing further investigation into this one case, I linked up with Ruben Uriarte, who at that point was working with the History Channel on a documentary for UFO Files, the History Channel program, and he had done a short segment for them about this incident. So he and I linked up, and Ruben, you want to pitch in how we've worked over the past 2 years on this case?
Yeah, Ruben, you might get a little closer to the microphone.
Yes. I'll just
welcome
wait.
To the show, by
Thank
the
Thank you,
way.
Jerry. It's great to be back, and I'd like to say hi to my friend Farah.
Yeah, right. She's in New Jersey today.
Right.
She wanted to come, but she's got other business she had to take care of.
Great. As Noe was saying, I was involved with the History Channel on a project on basically they were doing a segment on on Mexican UFOs, and I had a number of connections thanks to Mr. John Schuessler, who was our former international director. I'm with MUFON, Northern California. I'm the state director.
Right.
And what had happened was I came here 2 years ago, Jerry, just as a spectator, and there was Ryan Wood was talking about the various cases, and he mentioned Koyame, and I was familiar with that. But what was interesting was that the History Channel decided to do a whole series of crash retrieval cases, and one was Mexico's Roswell. So what happened was, it's all by fate, I would have to say, that I had a chance to be on the show, and that's how we connected. Noe had called me and was asking for a number of information, and so we're working together, and then Noe said, hey, let's work together on a book.
Well, now, here at the conference, you presented some new material, I think.
Yes, we're going to be doing that from our several investigations that we've conducted throughout this past year.
We'll talk a little bit more as we go, Jerry, but one of the things that has really helped us is there's been a lot of interest in this case among UFO researchers, and just 2 weeks ago, we returned to the site where this happened with a national cable channel, television production crew and cast that funded a return to Koyame for us, and we went along as their technical advisors, and we also did on-camera interviews, a program that's going to be shown in February or March of 2008. So the additional interest and funding that they were able to provide for these television folks gave us an opportunity to do even more research into this fascinating case, which in a lot of ways resembles the 1947 crash retrieval at Roswell, New Mexico.
Yeah, and we talked about that a little bit in Roswell. Let's go for people who have not heard that interview. It's still available on our website, by the way. But what's the similarities here? What are the things that have happened?
Okay, we have a very mysterious incident in which a UFO and a small civilian airplane crashed in mid-air collision near the Texas-Mexico border in what is known as the Big Bend region of Texas. That's near the small Texas border town of Presidio, Texas, which Ruben and I have been to several times when we've crossed over to do this investigation. So the plane, the mid-air plane collision occurred there on the Mexican side, just within 30 miles of the Rio Grande River, which demarks the boundary between the U.S. and Mexico. Mm-hmm. So we went. So the plane crash went down, and then there was a crash retrieval team that was sent in by the U.S. side after the Mexicans had attempted to recover the objects that were involved in the collision and had started to recover it. And then something caused all the Mexican soldiers at the scene basically to die. And Ruben, why don't you pitch in here and tell what happened?
Ruben, when he says they die, they literally dropped over then or
yes,
later?
Well, during the time that they were going back, they retrieved as Noe was saying, the UFO and the airplane crashes. They were being observed by military reconnaissance aircraft as well as the spy satellites. And what they saw were a number of dead Mexican soldiers, which then alerted the retrieval team coming out of Fort Bliss to fly a group of helicopters to fly in there and immediately start working on retrieving the disc. And as a result, they wore, what we're finding out based on this document, they wore biohazard suits, which then later in the document also stated that they gathered the bodies of vehicles and exploded them. And they brought the disc back to the on the other side of the border, and then through the report, it indicated that it went to Atlanta, Georgia, or at least that was where the convoy might have gone to.
Well, and how many died, do you think?
We estimate that there were that it was a squadron of up to 24 Mexican soldiers who were involved in the recovery effort. They had been sent out of the army base in Ojinaga, Chihuahua, which is right across the border from Texas, and they had gone through the desert roads there north of Koyame and had found the crashed silver disc, which was about 15 feet in diameter and about 5 feet tall, and they had found that not far from the debris from the small plane crash. So they found the two sites relatively close to each other, and they gathered together all the remnants as well as the crash disk, which was virtually intact. And we'll talk more about the disk as we go along. But they gathered up all the pieces and they headed back to their base. And that was when somewhere along the way, the effects of whatever they were exposed to started to kick in, and they basically, the convoy of Mexican trucks stopped in the desert about midway back to their army base, and then everybody, all the soldiers that were involved in the retrieval team for Mexico died.
So did they get a fever, or did they just keel over, or do you know?
The problem there, as Ruben can give you some more insight into that, but the problem there is that we don't have access to the bodies or any information about examinations. Ruben?
This is going based on the report or the documents that we read on about the It must have been very quick because all of them died.
Right. That is just amazing when you talk about that.
Of course.
And then they sent the information to Atlanta to the...
The Center of Disease Control is what we were speculating, is that's why we could have gone there or maybe some military base nearby.
The most advanced facility in the world in the early and mid-1970s, the most advanced facility in the world for handling biohazardous materials was the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, which was in its heyday, really. It was, you know, it was dealing with a lot of emerging viruses and things in the early to the mid-70s that presented worldwide threats for epidemics and so forth. So they had premier facilities, level 4 biohazard containment and research facilities there in Atlanta. And so we feel, and based on the UFO investigators that have helped us with this case, we feel that that's why Atlanta was chosen as a destination. And initially, the reason we feel that the U.S. team had to go in and make the retrieval after the Mexicans died was because of the extremely close proximity to the U.S. border. So we had the threat of an Andromeda strain type scenario where some kind of extraterrestrial virus would become like spread like wildfire across the southwestern United States.
Now this happened in 74?
Yes, August 25th, 1974.
You know, just to jump in here real quickly, what Noe mentioned about Andromeda strain, and Noe took me to this little town called Shafter, and that's only how many miles from that is?
It's approximately 50 miles from where this incident happened.
And you figure, and that movie was made in 1971, is that correct?
It was released in 70 or 71.
So here we have almost a real life.
An identical thing. In fact, movies seem to reflect real life a lot. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Well, Michael Crichton was a medical student early in his career before he became an author, and so he was very much involved doing his graduate work and so forth. He knew about the U.S. procedures that they had in place in case of a biological threat. And that was the basis for his book, which was published in the late 60s, called The Andromeda Strain, which then was made into a famous movie by director Robert Wise, which was filmed, as Ruben mentioned, partly in this desolate desert country there in West Texas, where this whole incident ended up happening.
Now, what do you figure ETs, were they infected, or was there something released out of the crash, or what do you figure happened?
Well, if in the report they didn't state that they found any bodies or any occupants inside the disk,
uh-huh.
But doesn't mean that there might have
right,
been.
Right.
But the fact that they rapidly, they didn't say either in the report that they took any dead bodies back with them. I mean, the result was they had to go ahead and do a sterilization.
So we have no evidence of ETs at all. But
there is the intriguing element here, Jerry, that was contributed to us by longtime UFO researcher Robert Dean. He gave us a fascinating picture of a gray alien that was given to him by a former Mexican police officer while Bob Dean was attending a UFO conference in Mexico City. And this policeman came up to him and took out of his wallet this kind of crumpled little photograph of a gray alien. And the policeman told Robert Dean that this alien had been recovered at the site of a UFO crash near the Texas-Mexico border. And that's the only details that he had. And this happened in the early 80s, so...
And this is in your book, the picture of the ET on page, yes. What it page is?
Page 59.
Uh-huh.
We have the story that Bob Dean gave us of how he came across this photograph. And Bob Dean has a suspicion, which is, you know, there's no evidence in support of it. And we admit in our book that it's strictly speculation on his part. But Bob Dean feels that there is a connection between this ET photograph and the Koyama case.
What we started to find out, Jerry, as we got involved in our investigation, is that we were coming across a number of other crash retrieval cases, which was very interesting along the Texas-Mexican border.
So there have been several then?
Several, yes. And it, this leads into one of our it's leading to our second book, which we'll elaborate in a little bit.
One of the things that's happened along the Texas-Mexico border, Jerry, is... the U.S. has gone in and made retrievals of downed missiles and experimental aircraft that have gone astray. Because, as you know, most of the testing facilities for experimental aircraft and for rocketry, U.S. rocketry, is in the Southwest. Is in New Mexico, is in West Texas, is in Arizona, Nevada, Utah. So in Utah, and these... this military hardware, top secret hardware, has gone down in northern Mexico. Surprise. You know, and so the U.S. has sent crash retrieval teams down there to pick it up.
What do you to attribute that that happenstance to? Just because that's the way they're aiming the things? Or is there something going on the border?
Well, partly it goes back into 47 Operation Paperclip when they brought over the German researchers, von Braun, for example.
Yeah.
They were testing the V-2s, and we had two incidents of V-2s going off track and nearly going right into Ciudad Juarez, right across from El Paso. And then we had another incident in 1967 where a missile was launched out of Fort Bliss, and it landed near the area of Koyame. And then we had an Athena rocket that was launched out of Utah, and that carried cobalt-57 radiation material that hit in an area known as the Zone of Silence. So we had four incidents, but it's still continuing as of today.
Yeah. And we, of course, will talk about, when we come back from the break here, a little bit more about this. It's just intriguing about this Andromeda strain incident. And I don't know, have there been other incidents like this reported down in the Mexican, by the Mexican authorities?
There have been a number of UFO crash retrievals that have been made by Mexican authorities. We have been apprised of. We don't have firsthand knowledge of it. We've heard most of these stories from civilian UFO investigators in Mexico. And Ruben, some of the most engaging ones that have happened, maybe you can give just a brief summary of the ones you've heard of.
Let's let Ruben give that to us when we come right back. We're going to take a break. I'm Jerry Pippin. This is brought to you by UFOTV.com. And, of course, they offer videos on demand wherever you are. We have about 35% of our audience around the world. And if you can pick up the internet, then you can get these DVDs and other documentaries and video on demand offered by UFOTV.com. They make it easy for you to download to your computer. If you'd like to call for more information about that or to get the free catalog, the 2008 catalog is out there now, just call 1-800-350-4639. 1-800-350-4639 and ask for the free catalog. Or you can just go to UFOTV.com and browse and look around. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at the wide selection of downloads and DVDs available. The best UFO and conspiracy DVDs around at UFOTV.com. We left with Ruben Yortes. You were going to tell us about this, a little bit more about the incidents. And
As Noe was mentioning, that there have been a number of UFO crashes. 1948, for example, we had a crash that occurred near Laredo, Texas. Another one that through our investigations and looking through documents in 1949, was it Mexico City? There was another that occurred in, this came out of the MJ documents, Jerry. Uh-huh. Mentioned Roswell, but he also mentioned another crash near the Texas-Mexico border near Del Rio, Texas. 1950. And then, of course, Coyame, 1974. And recently, we have come across a very interesting case, and the witness is still alive today. He's a former Air Force fighter pilot. He flew F-86s back in during the Cold War, actually.
Uh-huh.
And but this gentleman here, by the way, was a World War II veteran. He also was a Korean veteran as well. And basically, one day they were doing a military exercise. They were escorting a group of B-47 bombers, and they observe an object coming over them. And Willingham went to investigate, pulled away from the flight, and observed this object falling over toward the Mexican side of the territory, on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande River, crash. And it gets even more fascinating. We shared with Noe, and I interviewed him extensively. He, by the way, he said he flew back to the crash site, him and another gentleman. He landed the small airplane right along the banks of the river. He crossed the river. And then he was met by a Mexican soldier. He spoke a little Spanish. He says, "We're here. We're waiting for someone from the United States Air Force to arrive." And when Willingham said, "Well, I am the United States Air Force," so they went up. So the military, soldier took Willingham up and had him take a look at the wreckage. And then he found it was getting dark. And some of the military officers there were getting kind of nervous. He then picked up, because it was getting dark and the situation was getting a little bit too nervous for him, he then started to leave, and he picked up a small piece of the retrieval. When he took that back, and maybe you could jump in here.
He didn't get ill.
No, he didn't. He saw
stuck into the side of a hill there. He saw this large silver-shaped, silver-colored metal disc, saucer-shaped disc, that had impacted, and it was partly buried into the sand. And it had made about a 300-yard furrow in the cut it into the sand as it crashed and skidded along before impacting into the side of the hill. And all along the furrow, he saw pieces of shiny metallic debris. He picked up one of those pieces, which he described as being about the size of the palm of his hand, and it was a metal unlike any other that he had ever known. His dad was a metallurgist, and he himself had done work with cutting metal with torches and so forth, and he was not able to make any impression. He was not able to burn it or scar it or do anything to it. It was resistant to any attempts on his part.
What happened to this metal?
Colonel Willingham was instructed by his superiors to turn it over to a government metallurgist testing facility in Maryland. And a few days after he turned it over, he called to check on its status. And the facility had been closed overnight, and its personnel relocated to unknown locations.
Wow.
And he never heard anything about the test results.
And what's interesting was, this is the other connection with the Roswell of 1947 in New Mexico. Again, you know, we have Jesse Marcel touching, who's the intelligence officer, touching fragments of a downed UFO. And then here we have Colonel Willingham, who's also holding a piece of metal from a retrieval.
He received a letter, anonymous, with no return address, many years later. And he, even though it didn't have a person's name or an address, he felt that because of the contents of the letter, that it came from somebody at the lab. And it said simply, he opened up the letter, and it said simply, the metal you gave us has properties like no other metal we have ever tested. And that's all it said.
And that's all, the whole thing.
Then something happened to him. As I mentioned earlier, he was in World War II in Korea. He was injured in a Korean battle. And basically, as a result of his injuries, he was hospitalized. And then years later, he had some health complications, and he was about to retire from the Air Force. Well, prior to that, when Willingham was warned by his commanding officer, he says, "You are not to say anything, or there will be severe consequences." Well, when he was about to retire, they denied him his pension.
Wow. You know, you had some examples of crash material here. Tell me about that. That we have a picture of it on the website.
Yes.
What are we looking at there?
Yes. These are aluminum pieces of the field debris that we had found with some of the locals here in Koyame. And I have to tell you this. I forgot to mention that Koyame, by the way, is still a hot spot. We have a number of people
things
that
are still going
still
on.
Very, very interesting. Very eerie.
You like sightings or
number of sightings, UFOs landing on they're out there in the ranches, objects being seen.
Is there something about this area that would attract them that you could figure out?
Well, you know, this is something interesting. You know, the Marfa lights aren't too far away. And
yes.
Chinati Mountains and...
And the Zone of Silence.
The Zone of Silence is very... You know, it's at Mexico's Bermuda Triangle. It's all within 100 miles.
What we can say, Jerry, is that it's a very out-of-the-way, isolated desert location where there's plenty of places to hide. If there are secret underground facilities there, there could be underground things. There's... caverns there and places where you could hide things from any kind of surveillance, including satellite photography. Now, when Ruben and I went down there to follow up on the supposed crash in 1974 of this small plane and the UFO, that's when the villagers from the small town of Koyame took us out to the desert, and they showed us this field that was littered with the debris of a small airplane that had crashed there. Now, we don't know with 100% certainty that this is the plane that crashed with the UFO, but we went down there and we collected samples, which we've given you
a
piece of.
Right.
And what it recently, on this last trip where we went, that was funded by the cable TV channel, Dr. Ron Milioni, who teaches at St. John's University and has a degree in electrical engineering and mechanical engineering, he went down with us and he told us that the condition of that melted aluminum, which it melted under intense heat and then jellified into a solid state, and you can see it littered all over the desert. We gave you a piece of it. That is not the kind of wreckage that you would find in a typical airplane crash. In other words, there was intense heat generated in this. They bagged up many samples of this, which they took with them for further analysis. They took soil core samples. They tested the area for radiation. This was the thing that Ruben and I were very happy with, to actually do some, to have the funding to do some of these sorts of tests that we couldn't do on our first expedition down there.
We will be right back. I want to talk about your new project coming up here. It's a new book, right?
Yes.
And there's a couple of things I still want to follow up on this. And I want to get to the exact location for somebody if they want to try to find drive down there.
Sure.
It's probably not easy to get to.
No it's not.
Yeah, we'll be right back. This is Jerry Pippin. I want to talk to you about UFOTV.com for a moment. The 2008 New Science Ideas Catalog is now available. And it has such topics as UFOs and controversy, politics and science, mystery and wonder. This is a free catalog that you can get by simply just dialing the 800 number I'll give you in a moment. And we'll talk about basically everything that UFOTV.com has on programs coming up. They not only have the best DVDs and the best conspiracy DVDs, but they also have all kinds of downloads, and they're all, including e-books and rare articles, and rare things that you just don't find in a library anyplace. But Tim and everybody at UFO TV has been able to get the great e-book section there. So you need to go look at the entire website, if you can, at ufotv.com. And they offer videos of downloads, and they're convenient and they're easy to do. And if you want that free catalog, just simply pick up the phone and call 1-800-350-4639. Or go to ufotv.com, and there's a place to order the catalog. It's free. 1-800-350-4639. When we talk about your new book, what is the deal on the same subject, or we got something else going on?
Well, as Ruben mentioned, we ran across the Willingham case, which is the Texas jet pilot who chased a UFO and then saw it crash near the border near Del Rio, Texas. We ran across this story while we were investigating the Koyame incident. So we have two separate crashes. And this next one will be the basis, the Willingham story will be the basis of our next book. He's given us hours of testimony. We went to his house there in Texas. He's 82 years old, but he's got a sharp, clear recollection. He gives us specific details. He gave us copies of his military records. He gave us detailed information and photographs from his military service. He is a credible, verifiable, reliable witness, and that is basically his story forms the basis of our next UFO book.
Now, when we talk about his story in a thumbnail sketch, what exactly does the story entail?
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, he was that particular day who was flying with a group of B-47 bombers. He's an F-86 pilot.
The reason I get back to him is, does he have any evidence that we've ever shot down these things?
That's a very good question, is the fact that this happened in 1955, but during the early 50s, we know that there were orders out there for military, Navy, and Marines, as well as Air Force, to try to intercept UFOs and shoot them down. And
we asked Colonel Willingham that very question. What did he feel brought the UFO down? And he told us that he's not sure if it was being chased by others, if there was some kind of secret operation going on to bring it down. But he did know that he saw the object traveling at over 2,000 miles per hour. It was headed from the northwestern United States down toward the south, and then suddenly it made a 90 degree angle turn, still going at over 2,000 miles per hour. And of course, there was no kind of conventional aircraft at that time or even today that can do something like a maneuver like that. And then shortly after he made that right angle turn, he noticed that there started to be a wobbling effect, as if the object was suddenly starting to lose control. And then after that, it started descending rapidly. As he followed it, he saw it descending at a high rate of speed. It nearly clipped the top off a farmhouse right along the border there near Del Rio before it finally crashed along the river, the south bank of the Rio Grande River.
We only have about a minute or a minute and a half left. I want to get back to the soldiers dying, 24 of them. Anybody else die down there over this whole period of time?
Well, what's interesting is that we haven't
come
across that.
I mean, with an unexplained thing?
We haven't, but we have been putting it out there through our contacts in Mexico of any family members who may have lost loved ones during that period of time. And something that we had found through our investigation was Mr. Malson's team. They had done some preliminary investigation. They found documents in the newspapers of where there were some soldiers that were killed in, mysteriously in the car accident.
The problem is, Jerry, that a lot of the military deaths in Mexico are not very well documented. The victims' families do not have many resources or recourses for tracking down what exactly happened. The military will put out a story like X number of individuals died in training maneuvers in the Chihuahuan Desert, and that's it.
And that's
all you get.
That's all you get.
That happens even here.
This has been fascinating. I wish we had more time. I appreciate both of you coming by, Ruben Llorente and Noe Torres. And Noe Torres, before we go, give the name of the book again.
The book is called Mexico's Roswell, and it's available at all your online bookstores, as well as it should be able to be ordered from any local bookstore.
And you have a website, too.
The website is mexicosroswell.com with no apostrophe, mexicosroswell.com. The book sells for $13.95.